Welcome to season 20 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome back. Season 20 is moving right along. In this week's featured conversation, I'm joined by my friend Jay Shaw, and Jay is the CEO of Personal Capital. And I get excited about a lot of interviews. I really love the ones I do in person. And so this took place when I was in San Francisco. I got to spend 45 minutes or an hour one-on-one with Jay in their company's headquarters. It was just fantastic. And sometimes when you sit across from a man or a woman to interview them, you just get a true sense of who they are and how they lead. And you're just going to be so impressed by Jay and kind of how he leads from the front lines of a hyper-growth company, a company that you all can benefit from. I mean, you can download their app, Personal Capital. You can link all of your accounts. It's just it's technology and it's human and it's just fantastic. And I just loved my conversation with Jay. I think you're going to learn a ton from this because it's real world, real life stuff. Whether you're the CEO or not, you are going to learn some things from this episode that you can apply in your own leadership journey. So without further ado, here is my interesting conversation with my friend, Jay Shaw. Just a quick announcement before we get started. The next Ultimate Leadership Academy opens registration on March 20th at 9 a.m. It will fill up. If you're unfamiliar with the Academy, it includes our Elevate Others 360 assessment, a personal one-on-one coaching call, and four live webinars taught by me to help you on your leadership journey. It is the third of a cost of most other leadership development programs, and it takes you a third of the time to get up to speed. I hope you'll join me at learnloft.com. Well, Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
You are the CEO of a hyper-growth company, and I think a lot of people get excited about hearing hyper-growth anything.
Yeah.
When you say hyper-growth, what do you mean?
It's the accelerator rate at which we're growing this business. So hyper growth to us, one translation is we've grown our business by greater than 50% every single year since inception. And so that means by you're growing by a half size every single year, and it's on a bigger base, which is it's been wild. It's been an amazing journey. We call it the rocket ship.
I like it. And this rocket ship that you've referred to, it's both in revenue, it's also in technology, it's also in people. So let's start with the people aspect. You took over as CEO from a visionary leader in an industry that's had so much change. What was the first thing that you did in becoming CEO of a hyper growth company?
Yeah, well, just a little bit of my background. I've been here since day zero. So it might be a little bit unique that I wasn't brought in by an executive search firm and there's the new guy and he must be the newly appointed person. So you might imagine I'm sitting around the table with a bunch of colleagues and suddenly, you know, I was the CEO. How did I approach it? I had the benefit. I had a little bit of a head start. And what I mean by that is a few quarters before I was appointed CEO of Personal Capital, I was appointed CEO of Personal Capital Advisors Corporation. As you mentioned, we're half technology and we're half financial services. So the financial services half of our business is Personal Capital Advisory Corporation. It gave me a foothold or it allowed me to get in the door of a CEO group. And what that allowed me to do is take a step back from working in the business, rather work on the business and start thinking like a CEO. So I had several months of a head start of, well, how do CEOs think? I'm in here with a bunch of peers, and it's actually quite different. And for me, you know, I thought about this trajectory I had been on, and I was ambitious that one day I would be appointed CEO of Personal Capital. And I thought, hey, it's familiar. I'm on a path. I know all the people. I know the process. I know the technology. I got this. But it was an awakening for me that going from COO to CEO, the roles are actually diametrically opposed. You know, as a COO, you're required to make sure all the trains run on time, make sure everything gets done, make sure everyone collaborates together, which are still imperatives for my current job. But I don't do any of it myself if I'm successful. rather I empower the leadership team around me. So it gave me a perspective on how do I start building momentum and doing this from the perspective of CEO rather than the COO post that I'd held for several years leading into my new gig.
You mentioned a word in that, ambition. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about it today, actually, which is funny that you bring it up. Ambition can be super powerful. Mm-hmm. It also can be super, super hurtful mm-hmm. in ways. Mm-hmm. How did you channel your ambition to become CEO? And then how do you think about ambition for your employees? Is it good for your company? Is it bad for your company? How do you think about that word ambition?
I think the best characterization of ambition for me is why we're here. It's the mission, right? Why are we here? We're here for personal capital, transforming financial lives through technology and people. That's our mission statement. And that's ambitious in and of itself. You're here to help people, right? Any of us can be a working stiff and show up for a nice high-paying job in financial services. And at the end of the day, do you feel gratified? And so ambition to me is incredibly important. And so when we talk about being a hybrid or digital wealth management company, and half of our company is product developers and engineers, and that half can feel like I'm here actually to build things. It's going to change the world. Ambition is incredibly important. Or the other half of financial services professionals that may have come from another institution, and the way things were done were far different than the ambitious nature of our business to transform financial lives. It wasn't to make a profit. It's to help our consumer. It's an entirely different perspective. It's incredibly motivating for them. So I think ambition is incredibly important, and having a purpose-built organization or mission-based culture, we describe it as, it's incredibly inspiring.
It's so interesting that now that you're in the CEO role, that you think of ambition on the organizational side. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think many of our listeners or anybody that's out there trying to kind of escalate in their career and achieve things are thinking about on the personal side. Mm-hmm. So you start thinking about being the difference in that role, that CEO role to CEO. You already think like that, which I think is so interesting. And I think most of our listeners, I'm not sure all of their CEOs feel that way, which is an interesting dynamic that you're thinking that we're trying to be ambitious as a company versus just whatever your personal ambitions are as a person, which those things can be equate to each other over time, or they can be going opposite directions. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting that you think like that. I want you to take me back though to how you got in this business in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people always struggle with what's my passion in life, mm-hmm. What's my purpose? And I think you have a very interesting background as to one, how you got in this and why you continue to persevere or be ambitious in this space.
Yeah, I'll reflect on a couple, specific moments in my life. And one of them is, in the way back time machine, when I was a kid growing up, and I had this opportunity to take this summer job. And it was to go work at a credit card bank, and it was down the street, and I was able to get a ride there. And so, it sounded great. It was a good way to make some money. And I started that job in the summer selling credit cards. It was working at a credit card bank. And I can remember it vividly. My supervisor would walk around. We had a sheet of names that we would call out to and pitch a credit card. And if we won, meaning they said they wanted it, we'd take the sticky note and put it on an envelope and ship it off in the mail, and out went their credit card approval package. And we get flipped a silver dollar. And I felt good. I had no experience in financial services. I didn't know what it meant. It was lucrative. I was able to make money as a kid doing this thing. And I felt pretty good. And that was the first half of my summer. But then the second half of the summer was a little darker than that experience. And I was given the opportunity to work in customer service, which is code for collections at a credit card bank. And when I started calling out to people and talking to them about a balance due to the bank, and I would start hearing the personal stories come across about, well, I'm a good, tax-paying citizen. Why do I owe you any money? It hit me that these people didn't know what a credit card meant and what it meant to go into debt and not be able to ever claw yourself out of debt. And so as good as I felt at the beginning of the summer, I felt miserable by the end, knowing the wreckage or the wake of destruction that I'd created by pitching those credit cards. And it just made me think about financial services. Then I remember the image of that bank, it changed quite a bit for me. And these were early days. And now I've been doing financial services, fintech, technology for 20 plus years. And about a little bit more than a decade ago, I had an opportunity to work in financial services, but at a purpose built or, you know, mission-driven organization. It was a company by the name of Elon, and some people might identify with that name. Like I said, it was about a decade ago, and we offered a broad swath of consumer lending products to our consumers, but we did it with technology and data in a way that would help open the eyes and transform consumer lives. And the really important thing about Elon was we were the force behind getting a FICO score, a credit score shared with a consumer. That didn't used to happen. And a lot of people just assume that that's the way the world is. But Elon drove the legislation in California and ultimately on a national scale, which made that information available to the consumer. And we felt really good about people now having a score that should correlate with the credit they should that they should deserve. And so being part of that and transforming things, it really gave me this, you know, I got inflicted with the opportunity of working at something that had, you know, more than just showing up, but doing things right. And in contrast to that summer job I had, you know, probably a couple decades before that, that was inspirational. And it really shaped what energizes me here at Personal Capital.
In today's world, it's talked about, but not really. You know, so many people get that credit card and don't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think you mentioned there's two big questions. This is like almost a finance lesson, but I want to mm-hmm. go there because it's so important. Mm-hmm. You mentioned two questions that everybody should ask mm-hmm. as it relates to this kind of stuff. What are they?
Well, in wealth management, I mean, the big profound questions, the two most important questions are you diversified and what are you paying in fees? We talk about that a lot. And it's a very elusive question, but it's the most important thing. And I think part of the consumer perspective is, oh, I just need to get a credit card or a bank account and a wealth management account. They don't think about how it all hangs together. And they think more about, you know, their near-term needs. I need to have a place to park my money, maybe earn a yield, or I need a place to pay for things and I'll use a credit card. So very short-term oriented, but it's what they've been sold. Mm-hmm. You know, it's frankly, it's how most enterprises and financial services traditionally have been compensated. It's for profit reasons. But what we think about is the long end of the curve, which is more outcome oriented. And it's what we've been building at Personal Capital to make sure that people understand profoundly the short-term decisions or what they have right now and the opportunity path forward. But there's an opportunity to change and do things that are in your own interest that will improve your outcome. That's way more important than those short-term financial transactional things that people typically engage in.
As you think back to where you kind of got your purpose for getting in this space in that first job, mm-hmm. selling and then collecting, mm-hmm. Now you've been in this space 20 years. Mm-hmm. Is your advice that you would give our audience the same about personal finance exactly the same or has it shifted?
Over the arc of time, I mean, I think you talked about, you know, my leadership style, right? You said it doesn't sound like it's about you. You're sounding, you know, it's more about the cause or about the people.
Right.
I think about financial services that way too. If you think about, you know, the enterprise or the firm that's selling those services, that's more about profit and transaction. I think the world is still unwinding from that perspective. The advent of financial services or fintech, new tools and ways to see your money that, you know, people didn't want to tell you before. That inspires me. We're in an industry that, you know, wealth management is a $30 trillion industry, right? It's greater than gross domestic product. There's massive amounts of money here. And there's massive amounts of consequence for people making bad decisions.
Right.
So being part of how transforming financial lives or helping unwind the retirement crisis that exists in this country. Like, I think much more about all these people that we serve, right, than I did early in my career. I mean, this was a summer job. Right. How to make some money,
right?
But I think much differently. And yeah, that's very much evolved over decades. But it's important. It's why we're here. We have an opportunity to change it.
While we're on this subject, because before we get into leadership and culture mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. What's one bit of advice that you would give a 20, 25, 30-year-old professional now with your experience in finance? What's one bit of advice you would give them?
Never stop learning. And it's what we just described. I mean, I spend a lot more of my time now learning than I've ever done in my career. And you can never stop. I mean, I think when you stop, you're going to stagnate. So that's the most important thing, is always have a curiosity, always go explore in whatever it is you're doing, whether it's in finance or whatever trade you choose. I think it's so important to continue to develop who you are as a person and as a leader.
I think it's just, I mean, it's true. It's true, isn't it? And I want to jump into personal capital and how you've kind of transformed this business and where you're going today. And I think it really stems from leadership. Mm-hmm. I think everything rises and falls based on it. And you're now 400 employees. Mm-hmm. You've brought a new energy and excitement just when you walk in here. You felt, you know, this place having this energy, like we're doing something big in this space. Mm-hmm. Has your perspective about leadership always been what it is today, or has it transformed as you've seen these things in your career?
Oh, I think it's ever changing. You know, I'm a student of the game of leadership. I'm in a CEO group. So I spend one day a month just checking out of the business. As I say, to get out of the business, to go work on the business. And I listen to speakers and their content. I have tools, and I have such a wealth of resources that I have at my disposal. And my job is to bring them back to my team, to empower the leaders that are around me. When I think of leadership, right, and what my remit is, it's interesting. I heard this recently. And so this tells you that, you know, the evolving nature. I mean, you go read all these books and you go get all this exposure. Of course, it's going to change. But the way I heard the triple crown of leadership described to me, and this really stuck with me, was vulnerability plus transparency plus humility equals authenticity. And to me, like, as I continue to be a student of the game, what's most important to me is that I'm real, that I'm genuine. Right? I mean, that's the most important thing. I'm my true self with whatever I see, whatever we're all going to continue to evolve. But that's the most important thing to me. So when I heard that described, this triple crown of leadership leading to authenticity, that's the most important thing. So I can't forget that. I can't forget who I am in spite of all the things that I learn and I continue to evolve. I think that's the most important thing.
Well, you can only be yourself from a leadership. I mean, you only can be yourself, period.
That's right.
So much of our world today is trying to get us to become something we're not, mm-hmm. because of social media or what we see somebody else doing. Mm-hmm. Has there been a moment leading here where you realize soon after that wasn't your authentic self?
You know, I haven't. In quite the contrary, actually. And this is shocking to me. I mean, you reflected earlier in the conversation about, well, not all CEOs behave that way or think that way or are that way. And I've had a couple moments, which is just it's such a reinforcer for me. I'm human, right? I need response and feedback like anybody else. And just a couple moments, even in the last quarter, just walking around, it's what I do, I think, to compress our organization, just to stay close to the people that are, you know, doing everything here. We have 400 people at this company, but everybody here is such an important part of who we are and what it is we're a part of and what it is we're going to do. And so I stay close with the employees. And I just had one of our employees, I'll leave her nameless, but she just said, I got to thank you. I said, why? And she said, because you just come over here and talk to me and you'll spend 15 minutes and tell me about what you did for the weekend or what we're working on strategically. And you just, it never occurred to you that you're the CEO and maybe you don't have the time to do it. And she just said, I've just worked at so many other companies that just don't think or operate like that. And that it just touches me. But I can't imagine what it would be like in this day and age to go work at that company where, you know, it's an ivory tower, or they're disconnected, or all that stuff happens somewhere else rather than engaging the collective wisdom and experience and skills that you have across your entire workforce. I mean, we're 400 people strong. I mean, why would I ever do something that would be just individually driven or even just a group of less than 10? Isn't that fractional as opposed to what's possible if you're actually able to engage people? So a couple moments like that just reminded me the importance of this type of leadership style to stay engaged and ask people, how can I help you? Or behave, more importantly, behave the way. And how can I help you? How can I be supportive of you? That tells me I'm on the right course. If I ever deviate from that, I should not be doing what I'm doing. I firmly believe that.
No, it's good. It's good insight. And not every CEO does it. I mean, I think you do it and it's great. We see a lot and not everybody does it. And, you know, there's so many stories of the C-suite on one floor and everybody else on the other, don't eat lunch together and, you know, only can go to lunch with certain people. I mean, that stuff happens every single day in companies all across the world. And so the fact that you're doing it seems normal. It's not normal. As you've scaled, as you hire, as you raise money, how do you think about scaling leadership across the organization? Because you can't be everywhere. I mean, there's too much information today, Jay, to think that you can make every decision or you could be everywhere. So how do you begin to think about how do we scale leadership across the organization? Because we very much believe that you can lead right from where you are. So how do you go about doing that?
I think it's engaging others, right? I surround myself with very, very, very talented people. And I'll start with my, you know, a group that I call Council. It's my direct reports. And we meet for hours every week. And we talk about, you know, what do we need to do? What do we need to be doing differently? But it's not me telling them what to do. I try to approach that by asking questions. What do we need to do? And it's all of us together. Engaging people in that way is so important. You know, we talked about different types of leadership style. Today, I think the old way is dead. I mean, you need to attract and retain employees, and if they've seen this way of leading their professional lives, I don't think they're going to go back. And so it's imperative that you engage people. And so how do we scale leadership? I start by that, you know, set of direct reports or people. So we're all in the same conversation. We have a common purpose. We talked about, you know, values, but principles, a common mission. What's our vision? What are the values that make sure that we're living it that way? Making sure that's inculcated across this team. Because if we walk out of the room and if there's any, you know, inconsistency there, it's going to all unravel when you walk out of the room. So then going beyond that team, and we have an execution team, which is comprised of tens of people. You know, this is a leadership team in a company of 100, but there's tens of people across this team. We just had an offsite on just a couple days ago. And it was to talk about our strategic plan with 50 plus leaders in the organization, is to make sure people understood, here's our strategy, but here's how it connects to our plan for this year and the big goal that we have 10 years out. And so for me, leadership is making sure that we're all on the same page. So it's alignment, it's communication, visibility, transparency, some of those things I talked about before. It's empowering all those around me, because there's a lot of smarter people than me surrounding me throughout this entire company.
It is one of the things I really wanted to dig in with you, which is you mentioned this word strategy a couple of times. Yeah. And Bill McDermott, the CEO of SAP, said the one thing a leader can never be forgiven for is having a bad strategy. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought of it that way because, you know, you're oftentimes, I mean, football coaches build a strategy for the game and it doesn't work, so they have to modify. So there's parts of me that I agree with that and parts of me that doesn't. In a business this changing, mm-hmm. this fast, mm-hmm. How do you build a strategy and how often do you modify that strategy?
You have to have a strategy that's clear and that you can articulate. It's what I just talked about a couple right. days ago, making sure that everybody's on the same page with it. But I also would say that it needs to evolve. We don't live in a static world. You said it yourself. So we do, we'll examine what are our strengths, what are our weaknesses, what are opportunities, or what are threats or even trends that are going on in the macro world. We do that at least quarterly, just to make sure that we don't get locked in this little vacuum and it all sounds perfect from here. We have to go test and make sure that what we're doing, what our strategy is something that that is still on point. I'm able to. I talked about, you know, doing that with a leadership team. The importance of having a diverse set of skills, experiences, and perspectives to evolve a strategy. Again, if I can go invent this all myself and say, "Here's my strategy," and cast those tablets down from the mountaintop, that to me is. It's suboptimal. If I can get the perspectives and the strengths and, you know, everything from not even just my executive leadership team, but those surrounding it, I've got a brilliant board of directors. They're a good set of consultants and advisors to check in with about our strategy. So I use all these as resources. I go in my CEO group and I see new tactics and techniques or modern ways of developing pieces of a strategy. The hard part is, how do you be consistent and clear about what your strategy is, but still keep it attuned with the life that's, you know, outside of the world that you're living in when running a company? That's the art around it. But engaging people, engaging all of those resources, checking in, but also being clear on what that strategy is and communicating it well. I think that's the art.
It's really interesting stuff. And one of the things that's come up a lot lately in the world of leadership is, you know, this idea of kind of diversity, inclusion, things of that nature. And I don't want to get into that side of it. What I want to get into is something you mentioned, which is diversity of thought. Mm-hmm. How do you make sure you surround yourself with people that don't think like you? And then when they share something that you don't necessarily agree with or like, how do you handle that?
Well, I'm going to go back to that topic that you said. I don't want to go into all that because I think it's deeply rooted in what are the diverse upbringings that people have.
Right.
And so we, you know, there is a little bit of a, you know, in vogue of, about diversity and inclusion, but it's there for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Because if I hire people that walk like me and talk like me and, you know, we're all going to attack a problem the same way. And so whether you talk about opportunity or problem or challenges or conflict, there's no better way to approach that than with a diverse set of skills, ethnicities, sexual orientations. Right. It's everything. And yeah, it's one of those topics and it can be a touchy one, but I tell you what, we're accelerating into that. And it was actually a really important part of our discussion in this offsite that we held just a couple days ago. And how do we embrace that? But how do we, you know, it doesn't start and end with diversity. It's about inclusion, because those people that we bring in from all different walks need to feel welcome, need to feel safe. We need to build that in the culture of our company. But that's exactly how you get to the best answer. That is the key to building the best solution to any one of those challenges, problems, opportunities. I'm convinced. I have been for a long time.
I think it's wise. I think it's so wise. I mean, and there's just no doubt it's a big topic. And it tends to happen. Someone said yesterday to me that if you don't have diversity in your first hire, you're always going to be playing catch up. And it stuck with me. I don't know. I mean, it was yesterday, so not many things do. But I think it's really interesting. I mean, when every boardroom is middle-aged white guys, how much diversity is actually going to come from how you solve the problem or how you accelerate? I mean, it's just a fascinating topic that we're all in as leaders. And I think it might change by the size of the organization that you're in too.
It's not just going to happen by itself. I mean, it has to be very purposeful. It has to be by design. It has to be something that you're very thoughtful and aware of, and you actually have to cultivate it. That's the way I think about it, because if I look at our current state, we are not a diverse and inclusive organization, but we're on a journey, right? This is something that's going to happen over a long arc of time. And I don't know that we ever fully get there, but understanding that is also an ambition and something that we're solving for and being very purposeful in how we approach it. We've done a lot of work in this regard over recent quarters, a lot more than we have done in quarters prior. But it's imperative. If we want to be the most innovative, if we want to be the best digital wealth management enterprise, we're going to disadvantage ourselves unless we opportunistically approach diversity inclusion too.
Wise stuff. You talked about being a purpose-driven organization a few times. I don't know that there's a harder industry to be purpose-driven in than finance. I mean, we got one purpose. It's to make money, right? I mean, how did you think about becoming more purpose-driven? And then why is it important specifically in your industry? Because when I walked in this office, I saw core values. I saw a mission statement that went beyond making money. It wasn't just about profitability. Profits are important to keep growing and doing the things that you want to do. But how did you think about being a purpose-driven organization specifically in this industry?
Well, I think this industry, when you talk, and I'll talk about financial services. I won't even talk about the financial services writ large. When we started and now is broken. And so that was that we hatched our plan out of financial services being broken. That was the backdrop. That was the landscape at which we found this opportunity. And we think about it two ways. Consumers have complex financial lives. We all do it. You accumulate accounts over the course of your financial career, if you will. You have a savings account, a checking account, a credit. Suddenly you have too much that it's untenable to even understand how it all hangs together. So thinking about that as a problem, but then also thinking about the financial services industry. We talk about it all the time, where even those with the most scale are not consumer-centric in spite of how they may market. Rather, they're focused on selling the next thing. They'll sell a credit card or a mortgage or a bank account or whatever it might be. And typically the right hand and the left hand are not in sync. So in spite of all that, you know, scale, they're actually not built around the purpose that we're built around, which is the consumer. And so that was our opportunity, is to go build it the right way around the consumer. And understanding that that was our objective, if our mission is built around the consumer, as it is, transforming financial lives, there's nothing about money in transforming financial lives through technology and people. It's all about that consumer. But if we opportunistically in this morass of financial services can build something that empowers the consumer but also fuels a hyper growth company, and we can have alignment in ways that I've never seen before in a financial services company, that's a power to behold. And that was our opportunity. So I agree with you. It's really, really hard as an incumbent to have a purpose-driven culture when you think about it's been built on decades old of technology and there's mm-hmm. broken compensation schemes and it's all built on a foundation of selling product. That's how you've made your money. I mean, we've talked to many of these largest enterprises and they say, we know what you're doing and how you're attacking it. Nice work. I'd love to do it, but not in my lifetime. There's too much to unpack here. We'd never unwind this in my days. And so that created an opportunity for us. So what I would say is it's very, very hard for the incumbents to be purpose-driven. There are some that are out there, and I commend them for doing what they're doing. You know, BlackRock's a great example. Yeah. If you look at what's happening from the CEO down through the largest global asset manager. But that's rare.
It's very rare.
What we're doing with a clean sheet design, we've been at this for 10 years, but we started fresh to attack the problem that we saw. Still not easy, but it's a lot less complex than something that I think the existing enterprises are dealing with. And for us, it's a great greenfield opportunity to go do something the right way.
I was sitting with a venture capitalist last week, and he said to me, we started talking about purpose and leadership and culture, and he had all these examples of these companies that didn't have a focus on culture, didn't have a focus on purpose that had been successful. And then he, you know, shared some examples of companies that were and had failed. So he was kind of in this space of like, I don't know how important it is in our portfolio companies. And obviously coming from the perspective that I had, I didn't share much as to why. My question to you is, what's the ROI as the CEO? How do you think about what the ROI is of being a purpose-driven organization with a strong culture?
Ooh, so John, I'm sure there are white papers and studies that are smarter statistically than me on this one. But what I'll tell you is, I just talked about the alignment of the consumer and our enterprise. And if we can do that lockstep, it's very, very powerful. And when thinking about the consumer, I think the first order of business is having engaged employees. If you have engaged employees that are working on something that's bigger than all of us, that's inspirational. That'll get you out of the bed with, you know, with energy and speed
before the alarm.
You're gonna go attack that opportunity. And so if it starts there, if you can cultivate that through purpose with your employees, and then to your customers, I think it increases your odds. I don't know what the ROI is, but it increases your odds. And it's really hard. Just because you are a purpose-driven company does not mean you'll succeed.
Right.
It doesn't.
Still got to have the products, the services.
But if I'm taking a step back as a leader, and if I have the choice of being purpose driven or profit motive or whatever else might drive you, I'm going to pick purpose driven because it's inspirational for all of us. And that's, I mean, energy and that transfer of enthusiasm that happens from our employees over to the customer. I mean, I don't know what the return is, but it really increases the odds.
I'd love to know it too, right? And we define culture as the shared values and beliefs that guide thinking and behavior. Mm-hmm. The shared values and beliefs that guide thinking and behavior. You've defined five core values, I believe, in the organization, five or six, mm-hmm. I could be wrong. And they're little phrases,
yeah,
which I love. Any organization, we could walk in any organization in this building and you might see, you know, people. You might see, you know, just generic words that are their quote unquote core values. Why did you guys choose phrases?
Well, I think, you know, one word is interpretive. And so we pick phrases. I'll give you a couple.
Yeah.
You know, our first is, and they're memorable, they're catchy,
yeah.
right? But they're, it's not marketing, it's who we are. So our first one is we get behind being up front. And it says so much rather than just that one word. It says the importance of transparency or being forthright, putting it out there. We get behind being up front. Like, that's what drives us, right? It's who we are. It's what we're doing. If you think about this mission that we have within this, you know, broken space that we're thriving in. It's so important. And having a few words still doesn't mean that we're all aligned, but the most important evidence that it's vibrant and living mm-hmm. across our employees is we celebrate it. So once a quarter, we will have our employees recognize their fellow employee for those characteristics. And they'll give us an example. They'll write a story or a moment that happened that says, here's an example of we get behind being up front. And then, you know, our fifth one, and not in any particular right. way, these are just who we are, right? It's kind of our compass. It's self-describing of who we are. And it reminds people who we are and how we operate, how we behave. Our last one is we build and uphold our legacy of trust. If we think about what we're doing, people are entrusting us with their entire financial life to come and connect it to these free tools to see and have a richer understanding of where they are, where they're headed, and what's possible. But also, we're in the business of managing people's money. You know, we're a relatively unknown name out there. We're working on that.
Right.
But for us to own that, we have to make sure that trust thrives throughout the entire enterprise. So we have to remind ourselves the importance of trust. And that has to carry out in all the activities that we do every single day, leaders, employees, all 400 of us, and everything that we do, even when nobody's looking. These are the imperatives. And there are five of them, and there's just a couple, but it's so important for us to describe it in our parlance, but in ways that are repeatable across our employee base. That tells us it's real.
I think it's brilliant. Life. I mean, and again, it's not mind-blowing stuff, but mm-hmm. but they're yours. Mm-hmm. And that's what's most important, because you're not going to be around when everybody's making decisions every single day. So we have to trust people to make good decisions. And if trust is the ultimate human currency, it was being here in the Bay Area, the founder of LinkedIn, I think he said, trust equals consistency plus time. And so you guys have to make those decisions every single day to build trust with your clients. And one bad decision ruins it all, at least for an amount of time where you got to rebuild it. So I love that that's your fifth core value, because if I'm going to trust you, our listeners are going to trust, you know, the business with their money, mm-hmm. with what they've worked so hard for, with what they're setting up their families for. They have to be able to trust you. And they're not even going to talk to someone right away, right? So there has to be this innate trust with the brand, and that's built by the decisions your people make.
Absolutely right. So we think about trust in terms of meeting or beating expectations on a repeatable basis. And so if we position ourselves on this platform, on this podium, and we're doing something in order to shake up this industry, we better deliver the goods on that, if not go beyond that. Mm-hmm. And doing that on a repetitive cycle, it's how we are wired as humans. It's gonna beget confidence and clarity and trust in the things that we're trying to galvanize with our customers. It's an imperative. So that's why that statement lives within our value framework.
I didn't want to. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this, because I know a lot of people in the at all ages are concerned with this industry or thinking about it. If you look at what you guys are doing in Betterment and other people that are kind of some are removing the advisor, others are not. And so I probably should ask this when we were on the topic, but I think I want to ask it, because one of the reasons why I have an advisor is because if something bad happens, you know, I know my wife is taken care of. I know I have someone on my side. Your model is set up for both technology and people. Is that why it's set up that way?
Well, the reason it's set up that way is because that's what our customers demand. And what you just described, I think, is how we characterize money as entirely emotional, right? You know, when you're in the highs of highs or the lows of lows and you're thinking about your money, we're human. You can act emotional. When the market's riding high, you can get greedy. Or when the market's, you know, testing its lows, you can get nervous, you can get scared. And in most cases, those emotional decisions that are made by the customer are when mistakes are being made. And so we know that. We've studied this space.
Right, you see it.
We know that. But it's also what our customers ask for is I don't want to just go to some app or some digital endpoint and answer a few questions and then feel alone. You know, what we need to be responsive when somebody says to us, I'm scared. Or, you know, when we're helping with financial planning and, you know, suddenly they have an event, like I just lost a loved one. I don't know what to do next. And that's emotional. That's not just about, you know, generating a return on a portfolio, right? I mean, these are real human issues. And having a trusted advisor, somebody you can talk to, not only about, you know, the numbers and the growth, but rather these important emotional topics. So they're making good decisions. They feel like they have a partner in how they're approaching their financial lives as they seek out advice and so many other topics, you know, when leading their lives.
Well, I just think it's really important. The human element to your business in this world, it's just those emotions are real. And I know it's what our listeners are thinking. I mean, I know it's attractive to think that here's this app that I can go link and it's all going to be taken care of. It's going to grow. And that's great. But life happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, real life happens, meaning that if I died tomorrow, God forbid, that I'd have someone to take care of at least for my wife to call. I mean, just for a minimum of that. And so I know that's an important thing in your space. I think it's one of the real differentiators that you guys have is that you have this great technology platform and that you can link everything up and see it all. And it's just fantastic. But at the same time, you have the ability to have a human being helping you.
We think both. I mean, it's our design.
Right.
Being a hybrid.
It's in your mission statement. I mean, it's fantastic.
It says it right there.
I want to close on a couple fun things. The first is, what would be one word that your people use to describe you?
My aspirational word is authenticity. It's what we talked about before, that triple crown, right? Mm-hmm. That would be the one I would hope for. What I think they would say would be helpful. That's why I'm here. You know, I get this glorious role of making all the decisions and, you know, controlling all the resources, but it's not about me. It's about what I can do for them. And so I approach my leadership in a way that is trying to be helpful. So I think that's what they'd say. You'd have to go ask them.
Yeah, I might go ask.
I would also hope they would.
I really like the answer. It's the first time I've heard this is, you know, what I aspire to, and this might be what they say. And I like that. I really like it. It shows that you got a growth mindset. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of your people do as well. You have kids at home. What's harder, leading at work or leading at home?
That's easy.
Thanks for joining us for another week of the show. If you enjoyed this, please do me a favor and write a recommendation or review wherever you listen to iTunes. It helps us get exposure for the show. And as always, be a good leader at work and at home.
To work with fellow CEOs once a month on, you know, working on the business. I think about my board. I think about all of these incredible resources, money that we've raised. When I go contrast that to going home, so I have two daughters. Having two daughters, you know, ages 11 and 13, your customer is chaos, right? So our customer is not chaos. That's number one. It starts there. But then the second is I think of the amount of resources that I have, that we have, and we have each other to go run an enterprise. When you're running an enterprise at home for myself and my wife, and by the way, she's the CEO of my family by a large margin, that job is harder by infinity. It's not even close.
How often do you think of the example that you give your daughters?
It's a great question. I try to think about it more and I try to be much more conscious about it. But I think the most important thing is how I lead my life. I think the most powerful things you do are exemplary. They're not the words that you use or, you know, I think you have to be thoughtful in your approach, but I think it's leading by example is the most important thing to me for them.
I'm really glad you closed on that because I think your example here is just excellent. And I mean, as an outsider, that it's just fantastic. And so I really appreciate, one, your example of leadership for your people. And then two, understanding that you're in an industry that is super competitive and that you guys are doing everything you can to claw and fight and be hyper growth in this industry, from raising money to developing people to developing products. I think it's just, it takes leaders like you that are going to make these things happen. So we're appreciative of your time, and two, we're appreciative of your example for leadership. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, John. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.